My name is Gavin Schmidt. I'm a NASA climate scientist at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City.
So, Gavin, thanks very much indeed for coming in. We were talking earlier about the sort of role that scientists can play in the public debate about climate change and how many of them are quite reluctant. Obviously, some of your colleagues are very, you know, giving with their time on real climate. What are the issues there? Why are scientists sometimes reluctant to get into the fray?
Scientists are generally very, very eager to talk to people about their research or why they're enthusiastic about their research or what it is that they're discovering. They're very not keen on getting involved in arguments that they might see as not interesting or abusive or anything like that. They're not. Generally, scientists are very interested in doing their work and already have hundreds of demands upon their time. And so if they choose to engage with the public or in public, they want that interaction to be a good use of their time. To some extent, you know, getting involved in public discussion boards or talking about, you know, very current or very uncertain elements in the field, you know, it can just produce, you know, kind of coming out of the woodwork, people who are just interested in abusing them. And that's no incentive for anybody to get involved. But people are really eager to have people understand what it is that they do and the context in which they work. And when we on All Climate, you know, brought in, you know, guests and, you know, fellow scientists to talk about that, that's really what they've been excited about. And they've loved the chance to interact with people who are genuinely interested in what it is that they're doing. They find it very distressing if it just becomes a kind of gotcha moment with people who are trying to show that climate change is all some kind of huge conspiracy or a fraud. And that is no fun for anybody. So the more that that goes on, the less scientists want to participate. So we try really hard to, you know, keep the conversations on a level footing so that, you know, they are substantive and people who are genuinely interested can have interesting things to say and interact directly with the people who are doing the work.
The sort of detailed rebuttal role that the real climate plays of coming into the debate when someone says something that maybe gets a lot of pickup and kind of saying, well, no, actually that's wrong because of X, Y, and Z. Right. Some people might argue that it's perhaps counterproductive, that you know, by responding to the skeptics or by responding to people who spout views that are just clearly wrong, you're almost prolonging the discussion and giving them credibility. How do you respond to that?
That's a very good point. What I found, though, is that there is a huge hunger in, not a majority of people, but a large number of people, to actually understand more about what this thing called climate change is all about. And there are very few places that they can go, short of going back to graduate school or something, which obviously most people are not going to do, where they can find, you know, objective background information that isn't tied to an agenda, that isn't tied to somebody's polemic, either pro or con some particular policy action. Where do these people go? And the audience that we've got is mostly made up of those people, people who genuinely want to know more about the complexities, more about the background, more about how it all fits together and how the whole balance of evidence argument works, than people who are really just there to argue about the politics. And since there is that hunger, we try and feed that hunger. And what we try and do is use the more kind of nonsense arguments as stepping off points to filling in people on why it is that kind of argument doesn't make any sense. You know, what's the context for that argument that you should be thinking about, that when you hear some kind of contrarian point come up in the news or something, you think, oh, but hold on, that can't be right because of X, Y, and Z that I've already read about. And a lot of the recognition of bad argument comes from having a better context for the whole body of work that has been, you know, worked on for decades now, rather than, you know, just reading the headlines about, you know, the latest exciting paper in Nature or Science, which, you know, sometimes isn't right and sometimes gets corrected after a year or something. But if you have a better idea of the context, you know, the vast mass of information that isn't on the cutting edge, that is accepted, that, you know, people don't worry about too much, you can recognize dumb arguments yourself. And so it's so I like to see it as an empowering thing. So by giving people information, giving people the context, you empower people to make up their own minds when somebody is trying to string them a line, and to kind of muddy the waters on this issue.
Here in the UK, often the poster child for climate change is air travel, just because it's, you know, for individuals, it can be a large proportion of their carbon footprint. For example, it's an easy thing to bash celebrities over the head with, or politicians, or whoever. You think that sort of focus is really misplaced?
Well, airline emissions are about 3% of the global problem. The vast majority of the global problem is associated with power generation, transportation, and energy use in residential and agricultural uses. And deforestation. So there is a lot of scope for reducing emissions in those other areas that doesn't exist with airlines. There are no alternative fuels for airlines. Efficiency savings are going to be maybe 10-20% at max. And so if you look at, you know, how much energy is being devoted to the airlines compared to the potential benefit that you're going to get by, you know, people changing to bigger planes or flying a little bit less or something like that, you're seeing a lot of cost for not very much benefit. There are many greater areas where attention can be paid and new ideas tried out that have the potential to have a much greater impact than people flying a little bit less. Now, you know, that might be a little bit self-serving because, you know, like a lot of people, flying is my single largest addition to the carbon footprint. And so, you know, that is obviously not a good thing. But overall, it's not the biggest part of the problem. And like you said, it's easy to bash because it seems to be something that's kind of disposable that happens to other people. But in the larger scheme of things, it isn't going to be a big part of the solutions. And, you know, I think we should be not ignoring these things, but we should be distributing our righteous anger across the spectrum of things where we can make an impact.
Obviously, the big set piece moment for this year politically is Copenhagen, the UN climate talks in December, and you know there's a huge amount of shuttle diplomacy going on and numbers bandied around behind closed doors. What sort of result in Copenhagen constitutes a success? Or is that kind of not the point? I mean, is there something more at stake, more important at stake here?
The scientists aren't directly involved in what's being discussed in Copenhagen. The people in Copenhagen are discussing targets, timetables, accounting, and methodologies, which are very political and subject to all sorts of, you know, behind closed doors negotiating on various issues. The science, once it's given the politicians the signal to say that, you know, carbon emissions need to be reduced in order to limit the amount of climate change that's going to happen in the future, they're not paying much attention to the scientists now.
You were saying earlier on that the only people who ask you about this are journalists, and you know you don't talk to other scientists about Copenhagen.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's not one of the aspects that you know, I have communications with scientists all across the world. You know, we talk about a lot of different things that are going on in the science and, you know, in IPCC and with the next assessment report. Only one or two of these people talk about Copenhagen because it has kind of moved on from the scientists saying, look, we have a problem, to, okay, well, how are we going to go about dealing with that problem? And those are very different kinds of issues. Now, there is a role for science in helping define the policies that are going to help, but the policies aren't really being discussed in Copenhagen. In Copenhagen, we're talking about the timetables and the targets, and those are important, but they also are a little bit, not esoteric, but they're a little bit theoretical. By far the more important point is how you're going to achieve any of those targets, whether they agree on a 60% cut by 2050 or an 80% cut by 2050. To some extent, that's kind of moot because, you know, just saying that that's your target doesn't make it any closer to happening. The real questions that we have to be discussing, that policymakers need to be discussing, that governments and institutions and individuals need to be discussing, is how are you actually going to get those kind of cuts? You know, what are you going to do about power generation? What are you going to do about transportation? What are you going to do about residential use of energy? There are lots and lots of things that one can do, and there's lots of ideas out there for things, for ways that you could incentivize people to do the right thing at all different levels. And I think the science can help people with that. We can help work out whether, you know, a particular policy is a net benefit to the climate and to air quality maybe and to public health, and look for win-win solutions in all of those different fields, and the science can be very helpful there. But it's not up to the scientists to decide, you know, how the costs and benefits of these things are going to be distributed by the government, and how people who are going to lose out need to be compensated, and how people are going to win can make that happen.
The theme of today's show is the launch of the 10-10 movement. What are your thoughts on that as a campaign to kind of get people enthused and engaged and to actually hopefully make a sort of tangible difference?
Well, I think that's great. What we need to combat is this kind of fatalistic attitude that some people I have heard have, which is associated with this idea that there are tipping points in the system and that until we get there, we're okay, and then once we get past it, okay, we're in big trouble. Those kinds of discussions lead people to be complacent at the beginning and then very fatalistic afterwards. And it's a very bad framing for getting people to do the small and achievable things on the way to doing big things. So the 10-10, it's short term, it's small, but it is achievable. And so I think it is something that could give momentum to campaigns to do a much bigger job and more important job down the line by getting people to think, oh, you know, actually it's not so difficult to shave 10% here, 20% there, but it might be something that, you know, kind of prods the government to be more ambitious in the things that they can ask people to do and the things that they can change on a much larger scale.
I suppose it's important not to give the impression that, you know, once we've done our 10%, we've done our bit, because it kind of has to keep going, doesn't it, until 2050.
I mean, the big problem that we have is that however great we feel about ourselves in cutting our carbon emissions to almost nothing, that's still not going to be sufficient, because it's not that the biggest problem is not our personal use of energy. The biggest problem is how we run our cities, how we run our agricultural systems, how we run our transportation and power grids. And those aren't decisions that individuals, like just normal individuals, can worry about. They're decisions that are being made at higher levels. But we need to be prodding the people who are making those decisions at higher levels to have reasonable solutions that are commensurate with the size of the problem that we have.
And finally, your book, Climate Change, Picturing the Sciences Out Now, how did that sort of come about, and Perhaps you could sort of give us a brief audio tour, if that works, for a picture-led book.
Well, that is a little bit difficult for a coffee table book. This is a collaboration between scientists and photographers. These are photographers who've been working for National Geographic, Newsweek, all the big magazines. They started to get together to produce an exhibition on, you know, how to photograph climate change. How do you capture in an image slow changes or long-term changes and the way that it affects people? How do you do that? And they got together. They asked me to come and check their captions at a particular exhibit they were doing. And from there, we thought, we could do a better job here. We could really, talk about the science and, just give people the background that they need to understand what it is that they're seeing. And to get away from the cliches of, hurricanes and polar bears and penguins, to things that are more relevant. Pine bark beetles, a big issue in the American West, or changes in crops across Europe and where those can be changes in drought regime in the Mediterranean or in the American Southwest. These things are associated with climate change, but how do you go about photographing it and then explaining to people how this all fits together? And so the book kind of came from that idea, and the idea is that, this is how we go about working stuff out. These are the scientists who are doing that work. This is them at work. This is the human endeavor that is the scientific method when it comes to climate change. This is how we're doing it. This is what we've come up with. This is what we don't understand. This is what we do understand. This is where the uncertainties are. Without trying to bash anybody over the head with, a prescription for how you have to do things, it's very much, this is the landscape, this is what you need to know, that's the background, and you decide what it is that you should be doing or who it is you should be asking questions of in the future. So it's a great book for giving to, a somewhat skeptical uncle that you would meet at over the Christmas dinner table. If you're just curious and you want to know more, this is a great example of how to do that.
Good. I've got a Christmas present sorted already. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.